Hey there, welcome to another one of our Big Biller interviews. I'm here today with Jordan Raboy of Raboy Insider Search. And if you've been in the program a while, you know that Jordan is someone we've had on the program. This is now his third visit, which I think makes him our most revisited guest. And there's a reason for that. Jordan is a unique guy, which you're going to hear about today. He's someone who lives almost full-time in an RV and has done that for 10 years. And that's he's doing that while earning himself seven figures in his production and growing a team, and really has been a top producer for so many years and doing it in a way that a lot of people emulate. I hear about Jordan from a lot of you. He's taught for NAPS. He's taught for the Four Days Letter. He's done a lot of training. He gives back a lot to our industry, and he's a unique guy. So I'm really happy to have him here. Jordan, thank you for once again joining us for this interview.
Thanks, Gary. I'm happy to be your first hat trick.
That's right. Three. We might make it four or five. Who knows? But let's jump in, and we've got a few different areas we're going to cover. But just so people have a sense of the layout of your company, your org chart, how it's organized, can you give us a sense of what your current org chart looks like?
Sure. So we still mostly have a virtual team. I recently hired my first recruiter in a physical office in Plano. I'm going to be going down to Plano, Texas in the fall and spending about 6 months down there with the goal of hiring a few others. But for now, we've got one person in an office who's going to be an account executive. My admin slash researcher is home based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. My project director and her husband, who's an account executive, also happen to be my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law. They've actually been traveling for the past 2 years now, and I think they're trying to put down some roots in Palisade, Colorado on the western slope. My wife, Jessica, and I are currently in Alaska for the summer, although we also have a house in southern Oregon on the side of a mountain, and we probably spend more time in our RV than in any particular place. So
wow,
that's pretty much the entire team right now.
Yeah. And, you know, from the outside, that sounds like it's unwieldy, like it's a lot of different locations. Some people are virtual in different locations. You're in an RV. But I think you've got a very smooth system down. I know you have a smooth system down. So today what we're going to talk about is some of how you organize the company, the technology that allows you to have the systems in place to give you that freedom. But I'm glad you went through that because it sounds like a lot to keep track of.
Yeah, and I guess we all have to be a little bit flexible, particularly with time zones, and we tend to move the morning meeting around. If I'm up in Alaska right now, I can't commit to making anything before a 6 a.m. meeting, which is 10 a.m. on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
If and when I'm in Plano in the fall, I'll probably move that up an hour. So instead of it being 9 a.m. Central like it is right now, I'll probably move it up to 8 a.m. And Mark and Amy, who are in Colorado, that means they're going to have to do a 7 a.m. meeting. So we all tend to be flexible on that front. But really, the beauty of this business, as I've taken advantage of for 11 years now, is you can do it from absolutely anywhere, just so long as you have phone and internet connectivity. So, I have aspirations someday to spend a quarter down in South America because it's similar time zones to here, and just continue living the dream. So whatever you believe you can achieve, you can make it happen, so long as you're committed to doing whatever it takes to make it happen.
Yeah, and you've been doing it for a while with this kind of mobile lifestyle. So I think you've gotten the systems down really well, probably as well as anybody that I know in our business who has a virtual company and does it mostly from the road. Is your company regional, or are you guys national, meaning you take searches all over the country?
No, we work all over North America, both primary, secondary markets, as well as both commercial and federal.
Okay. All right. And with the breakdown of your staff, how does the support staff interact with the account executives? How do they sort of enhance your ability to increase revenue when you look at the researchers, the admin, whoever it is that's supporting the production?
Sure. Great question. So Christina, who is our admin researcher, her and I have been together pretty much since 2000. We started together. She was 18. I was 20. So about half a lifetime worth of trust built up between us. She gets more of a base salary and a higher guarantee than anyone else. She also probably earns more of her money in commissions and bonuses than she does in salary. So for starters, I pay her 1% of all cash in of the entire office because she just does so many different things to contribute to everyone's success. I feel like she should get a piece of everything. As the researcher, she would get another 4% commission on the total billings of any candidate that gets placed that she originally sourced and added to the database. Any job order leads that she originally sources, she gets 5% commission on those job order leads as well. So she's incentivized to always be adding new candidates from in the types of functions, from the types of companies we'd like to target, and always sourcing for new companies that we could try to market into.
Interesting.
So that answers it for Christina. In terms of Amy, who's my project director, the way I pay project teams, I don't know how deep you want me to get on commission plans, but
I think people really enjoy that based on the
level of responsibility and level of ownership they take in the process. So a brand new project coordinator who's just getting the hook into candidates and hand them off to the account executive, that person would get 15% of the deal or 30% of their half of the deal, if you want to call it that. A project manager who's getting candidates on the hook and then running the candidate side of the process, setting up interviews, prepping, debriefing, doing reference checks perhaps, that project manager might get 20%. And someone at Amy's level who's a project director who runs both the candidate and the client side of the process, I might take a job order, introduce the hiring manager to Amy, and then Amy will take the ball and run with it, and I might not re-engage on that search until we get a candidate that's at the offer stage, at which point I'm coming back in, covering the counteroffer again, checking for any red flags. But essentially, Amy just takes the ball and runs with it to the goal line. Amy would get 25% in that model. What I recently implemented, because I'm starting to hire more people, I wanted to incentivize Amy to share all of her wealth of knowledge that she's accumulated from 10 years of doing this. I wanted her to be incentivized and have some skin in the game to help these new people succeed. Anyone who's working on a search on my team, essentially part of my project team, Amy is not really their manager, but she is their mentor, and I'm paying her 5% of the billings of any placements that are made by any of these other new hires while they're working on my project team. So Amy gets to share in the wealth of any new hire success, and she also has a vested interest in investing her time to help them be as successful as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And with not sure if I lost my question here, but it was going back to Christina. You said that she gets 4% if she does the research or the candidate sourcing, I believe, right? And if she sources the search assignment, she gets 5% if that turns into a placement. Is that correct?
Yeah, so she gets 1% of all cash in. She gets an extra 4% if it's her candidate that gets placed. So she would get 5% commission on that deal, or she gets 5% for sourcing the job order lead as well. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, she could make up to 10% on a deal if she sourced both the job order lead and the candidate.
Right. And so people are going to wonder, the 5% for sourcing the job order, what does that look like? What does she actually do? Is she going through your clients' websites looking for new openings? Is she networking? How is she finding those leads?
Absolutely. So let's say we give her a list of 50 companies that are potential prospects that we want to target. She's watching their careers page. She's watching any new jobs that might get posted on LinkedIn. She's watching Crunchbase for rounds of funding that come in, for example. When she sees possible opportunities, she's also adding all the decision makers, whether it's president, CEO, VP of sales, VP of marketing, director of sales engineering, VP of HR, any of those decision makers, she's also adding into PCR, putting them on a marketing roll-up and, essentially doing everything possible so that the recruiter just needs to literally execute on making the calls.
Okay. So she's doing all the setup, she's getting it ready for them, and then she turns it over, and now it's the recruiter's job to make the contact.
Yeah, so it's just about outsourcing and delegating, taking these some of these planning activities, which I don't want to say they're not important, but I would say they're lower dollar value. Spending 20 or 30 minutes planning the call is less important in my mind. It's a lower dollar value activity than making the call and being able to capture that opportunity and actually get a potential prospect to commit to partnering with you and giving you that job order. So that's the same reason why I believe my highest dollar value activities are managing client relationships, landing job orders, and closing deals. I've basically outsourced and delegated the whole recruiting and process management to Amy, and Amy in turn has delegated a lot of the planning and candidate sourcing to Christina. So just keeping everyone in their swim lanes and maximizing everyone's time that they can invest in the activities that are the best use of their time.
Okay. So if you're, one of your AEs is planning, let's say tomorrow, they want to contact X number of companies, and Christina, is it? I believe Christina is the the one who does the search assignment leads, or is that? Yeah, Christina. So if she sends over, I don't know how it works, but if she sends over 20 new opportunities to one of your account executives, do they basically add that to their list of what they're going to be contacting for that week, or how does it the transfer work?
So it would probably just all be marked on the, all those hiring managers that you're going to be reaching out to at those prospective companies. They'd probably all be added to a roll-up list, and the account executive, the recruiter, would just open up the roll-up list in PCR, and there's your list of hiring managers. What she would probably do is copy and paste, say, a job description into that hiring manager's notes with some some little note from her saying, open position posted on LinkedIn or open position posted on company website, so that all you need to do is open up that hiring manager's screen, and in their notes you see the exact opening that was recently posted. You know, hopefully the recruiter is going to spend maybe a little bit of time during planning time, not right before they're about to make the call, but during planning time, go to that hiring manager's LinkedIn page, see what kind of common connections they might have, so you know who you might be able to name drop. Think about, oh, they need a sales rep in New York. Let me go into my database, see who I might know that could be a potential MPC without violating anyone's confidentiality, of course, but, you know, who might you be able to dangle in front of them, or what similar search might you have filled with other clients in the past that you can reference, just so you're as well prepared as possible to execute on that call. But you know, a lot of the time-consuming heavy lifting is done by Christina.
Okay, okay. And so just for point of clarification, you're saying that the planning time for the AE the night before is when he would do that extra work of figuring out what's the connection or what do I need to know before I make this call, and he's doing that at a separate time than the next day when he actually makes all those calls, right?
Yeah, no, you need to have a dedicated planning time every day, because if you don't have planning time when you do all these activities, you will absolutely be planning during phone time, and that's what's going to end up killing your phone time. And it's the same thing on the recruiting side as it is on the business development side. So, Christina, first of all, we send out a mass email for every single search that we get, because there's a bunch of reasons to send mass emails. But point is, Christina sends the mass email, let's say, to 300 people. The 30 or so people that might write back, she's the one who's going through those responses, pasting the responses into the candidate's notes in PCR, categorizing them somehow with a status symbol on the roll-up list, whether it's, you know, responded with interest plus their resume, or responded that they're not interested, or responded with a referral, or whatever it might be. So the project manager that might be working on that search, all they have to do is during planning time, open up the roll-up list, organize the roll-up list by status symbol, and they could look at the 30 responses in a row in a very efficient, focused manner and pick out, okay, of these 30 responses, these 8 to 10 look like they're both interested and extremely qualified. These are going to be my first 10 calls. These next 10, I'm kind of on the fence, but they're still worth calling just so I could qualify them in or out. And these last 10, these people are not a fit. I'm going to have Christina send them a second mass email eventually, just cutting all 10 of them loose at once, that the recruiter doesn't get bogged down talking and he can't help candidates.
Okay. And the organizing of the roll-up list, you're using PC Recruiter, and that's where all of that takes place?
Yeah, all that functionality is in PCR. I'm sure most ATS systems these days have some type of roll-up list functionality where you can customize the status symbols, where maybe one status is left the first voicemail, then left the second voicemail, then left the kill message, or made a presentation or took a CDS or is almost interested, need to follow up on their interest or got them interested, waiting for resume. You could customize these status symbols, I'm sure, in most of the ATSs out there.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned making sure that they're able to be on the phone in the morning without interruption or without planning during that time. What do you want your account executives to shoot for in terms of phone time? And has that changed, or do you think it's still a supremely important metric as far as time on the phone with clients and candidates?
Yeah, I mean, no matter how much technology is taking over our lives, the bottom line is this is a phone business. And if you are a recruiter whose job it is to hook candidates and get them interested in opportunities, you need to be on the phone talking to people. If you're an account executive trying to hook clients and get them to commit to partnering with you, you need to be on the phone talking to them. I have yet to hear an argument that carries any water with me where you're going to be more productive making 2 hours of phone time a day versus 4 hours. It just, it's simple math. If you talk to people for 2 hours a day, you are going to accomplish twice as much most of the time if you talk to people for 4 hours a day. The challenge is people feel so busy because they're multitasking, and what they're really doing is switch tasking from one thing to the next to the next, and they're not being as efficient as if they just focus on making a solid block of calls for 10 or 20 minutes and then checking their email versus making a call, checking an email, responding to the email, preparing for their next call, going on LinkedIn, looking to see who they have common connections with, you know, spending 5-10 minutes planning just so 98% of the time they could leave another voicemail versus doing all your planning at once, responding to all your emails at once, and making all your phone calls at once. And one tool that I've recently, in the past 6 months, started leveraging with my team that's been amazing, nothing short of amazing. I mean, it's the best tool I've ever seen. It's called CallLogic. It's basically an automated calling assistant. And the first great thing about it is it forces you, it literally forces you to be extremely well-planned, because for the call assistant to execute on a call plan, first you need to have a call plan and you need to upload or export, in this case, your call roll-up list that you're going to call off from PCR. You get the advanced APIs from PCR, and CallLogic literally imports your call roll-up list, and once you're ready to go, you hit go, and you can give yourself anywhere from 6 seconds till it makes the next call till up to a minute for it to make the next call. But literally, as soon as you hang up on one call, it goes right to the next call. And if you, here's the best part, you pre-record your voicemail, so it's a perfect voicemail. There's no ums, ahs, you knows, no filler words. And the best part is when you hit someone's voicemail, you don't have to sit there and wait to listen to their voicemail and then say the voicemail and then go to the next call. You just click a button. It automatically instantly deposits your voicemail into their voicemail and literally instantaneously just goes to the next call on the list. So what I found is I've gotten through, say, 22 marketing calls in 17 minutes while having 3 live conversations. Like, it makes the calls way faster than you could ever manually dial them. Plus, for those other 19 calls that I got voicemails, I didn't have to sit there leaving the same monotonous 19 voicemails over and over and over again, feeling like I'm a broken record. At the end of that call block, I was totally fresh. It's like, yes, voicemail, click the button, next, voicemail, great, click the button. I was so excited to just burn up a list and make such great progress. I don't care if I get a voicemail when I'm using CallLogic, because it's like, great, that much closer to a live conversation. So it's just been an awesome tool. You're going to be able to make more calls per day than you ever could manually calling through a list, and you'll be so much fresher at the end of the day where, say you make 100 calls and you left 80 voicemails, you didn't actually have to leave the 80 voicemails. You just click a button 80 times, and it leaves your perfectly recorded voicemail. So, yeah, so CallLogic, I'm a huge fan.
Okay, so now I'm going to have to ask you a whole bunch of questions because I know we're going to get questions about this. Tell me about their pre-recorded voicemail, because that's obviously, do you have different options, or is it just the one generic message? And if so, what message are you leaving? Is it, you know, because I'm wondering if, you know, for one company, you might actually have a candidate in mind. For another company, it might be a total complete cold call. For another, it might be a referral from Bob Smith. Like, how do you handle those nuances?
Yeah, so great point. So you can pre-record up to 6 different voicemails, but whatever list you're executing on, you need to leave the same pre-recorded voicemail for that entire list. So you're not going to mix, say, recruiting calls for one project with recruiting calls from another project. You're not going to mix recruiting calls with marketing calls. You're going to have a list of recruit calls on this sales search in DC and another list with another voicemail for this FE search in Dallas and another list with another voicemail for people that you're marketing a specific MPC to, for example. The only downside that I've found to CallLogic is you can't personalize the voicemail to whoever you're talking to. So instead of being, "Hey Gary, it's Jordan Rayboy with Rayboy Insider Search. Been a long time since we talked. Want to see how your wife and kids," you know, it wouldn't be like that. It would be, "Hey, it's Jordan Rayboy with Rayboy Insider Search," and you just need to generalize it a little bit without leaving someone's name. So if anything, that's the only downside that I've found, but thinking about it from a marketing standpoint, I would say if you've got a list of these 20 open jobs that your researcher loaded in or that you loaded in during planning time, I would not necessarily use CallLogic to execute on that because it's going to be a lot more specific about, "Hey, I understand you're looking for a sales rep in New York. We've recently filled 3 of those searches for other clients in the blank space in the last 12 months. I actually have an A player we worked with that our other client wasn't, you know, able to land, but would be a great fit for your organization." You know, it might be something like that. So I would say those targeted job openings, you probably want to make those calls manually. Although I know an office in Kansas City, Scott Samuel's office, who uses this for all of their marketing efforts. So it can definitely be done if you want to figure out how to do it.
So what kind of message do you know what kind of message they would leave if they're doing this, let's say, for marketing and it's going to be, you know, one type of call for that block or that set of calls? Is it just a general introduction? Is it kind of a mysterious message where you only give a little bit of information and then you try to tease them to call you back? What have you seen that works with calls?
So let's say you've got an MPC that you're trying to market to 20 different companies. I think that would be a good place where you could use CallLogic, where it's essentially whatever your MPC voicemail would be, just not mentioning the hiring manager's name that you're calling. "Hey, it's Jordan Rayboy. I'm an executive recruiter in the storage and infrastructure marketplace. Confidentially, I'm representing an A player from one of your direct competitors." Boom, 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 whatever your highlights are in that candidate. "Confidentially, he's looking to make a move, has identified your organization as somewhere he'd potentially be open to moving to as the next step in his career. Like to talk to you about him as soon as possible, see if it makes sense to line up a conversation. Again, it's Jordan Rayboy, 512, yada, yada. Thanks, have a great day." It's essentially just exactly what your normal voicemail would be, just leaving the hiring manager's name out. So it works for your MPC presentation. Let's say you don't have an MPC, but it's just, "Hey, Jordan Rayboy, executive recruiter in the storage and infrastructure market. We've placed 60 sales reps and 72 pre-sales engineers in the last 5 years with companies just like yours. Wanted to think up with you, see what we can do to help you grow your organization in the second half of the year." I mean, that's just a kind of vague marketing message. But something to that effect, just leaving all you got to do is get used to leaving the hiring manager's name out. But I'm telling you, the first time you use it and you've got a list of 30 calls, and you just click that voicemail button 27 times, and you're literally refreshed at the end of that list. Instead of having literally said the 27 voicemails, you just click a button.
Oh, I bet.
And you don't have to even have to wait. It just instantly goes to the next call. It's a kick-ass tool. I can't talk enough good things about it.
That's amazing. So, and I'm curious about it from a couple of different angles because failure-proofing behavior and getting people to do things through systems as opposed to willpower or discipline is a personal area of interest for me. And you had said that this forces you to be organized, obviously, and to plan the night before to set up the calls, I'm guessing. Now, does this just start dialing on its own, or do you have to basically initiate it when you're ready to go?
You initiate it. I mean, you get your call list all pre-organized. Also, for recruiters that tend to use a lot of filler words and could really benefit from reading a script, for people that have a lot of ums and ahs and you knows and shooting from the hip, and you know that they would be better if they just practiced a little bit and, more importantly, stuck to a script. And if it doesn't say ah, you know, or obviously in the script, then you obviously shouldn't use those words. So the great thing is, by pre-recording your voicemail, you know you've got it as good as you're going to get it, and every single person that's getting that voicemail is getting the perfect you, not a distracted you or a multitasking you or a you that just didn't leave your best possible performance on that voicemail.
Sure.
So yeah, it forces you to plan because you got to load a really well set up list in order for the for the tool to execute on the list. And also, it absolutely forces you to close your email, close any website you were looking at, close literally everything, and you have to be so laser focused because you're sitting there waiting for either someone's voice to answer, like, hello, this is Jordan Rayboy, or just for someone's voicemail to pick up. And you're so laser focused on this, on the screen in front of you, you don't have time to check your email or respond to instant messages or to go surfing personal websites. You're just super locked in. And I think you're going to be a lot more effective from that as well.
I love it. That sounds amazing. Is it, do you know if this is something where recruiters are using this every day? Like, this is just a part of their day. They spend however much time the night before getting it ready, and then they get in the morning and this is what they do. I mean, is this a daily thing, or is this something where people just do it?
Yeah,
every so
I mean, I think it's every search that you're executing on. I mean, obviously you're going to have your money calls where you're running process, you're prepping, debriefing. I mean, you've got your process calls that I don't think this would really apply to. But if you're recruiting on a search and you're calling a list of 100 candidates, why wouldn't you want to burn through those 100 as fast as possible and efficiently as possible? So I think every recruiting search you do, anytime you're either cold call marketing or MPC marketing, it will be a great tool to use. Something that's specific, i.e., if it's someone you've had a relationship with for a long time and it would be weird for you to call that person without mentioning their name, I probably wouldn't use it in that scenario.
Sure. Right. Okay. Okay. That's really interesting.
But on the flip side, I've got key clients where I might know 20 or 30 managers within a company that I haven't talked to for a quarter at a time. And you could leave the same message for 20 or 30 different managers talking about recent hires you made at their company and wanted to sync up with you to see what we might want to keep our radar up for top talent on your team in the next 90 to 180 days, for example. So you could still use it even with existing relationships.
Okay. All right. I'm thinking of, it's making my head spin a little bit because I'm thinking of all the uses that you could have, even potentially having a researcher do some of these calls, because that's one thing that we've experimented with some consulting clients of mine, where they will actually have researchers do some, we'll say, courtesy calls while they're on vacation, let's say. So if it's a small operator who's just one guy with maybe three or two researchers supporting him, depending on their level, sometimes they will make some courtesy calls to dormant clients to kind of reboot them. And even though they're not a full recruiter, they will make some of these calls. And I'm wondering if that would, it would be a way for the owner to know what happened while they were gone, I suppose, too, right? How many calls
actually
went out.
Absolutely. And ideas that I've been given that I haven't used yet, you could even have a college intern or anyone. Your spouse, your researcher, your admin, let's say you load a list up and you have them execute on this at 7 at night or sometime when it's not offensively late, but you don't expect many people to pick up the phone. So let's say you give them a list of 50 people. They could execute your campaign leaving your voicemail, and if anyone actually picks up the phone, they could just click a different button to hang up that call and go to the next call. So they're actually hoping not to get anyone live. But what they're doing is at 7 at night, they're leaving 40 or 50 voicemails on your behalf, and you might wake up the next day, come into the office, and you get a bunch of returned calls.
Yeah, I love that.
The calls that you didn't even have to personally make. So there's all kinds of ways to leverage the tool.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay. And the power of the speed is that it's automatically going to dial. The minute you hang up, it's going to just start dialing, basically, on whatever rest period you set it in advance. right?
Yeah, so if you have a live conversation, at the end of that call, you might have some action items, like you need to send them a follow-up email, you need to send them some collateral mm-hmm. in the search you're working on. You probably just want to have, like, a notebook where you give yourself a bunch of tasks that you're going to do yeah. in mass in a very focused manner after you finish this call campaign. But if you need to mm-hmm. quickly add some notes to the system, you can give yourself a window of anywhere from 6 seconds up to a minute. If you get someone's voicemail and you deposit the voicemail, as soon as you click the button to deposit it, it goes right to the next call. It's not like you could sit there for a minute and hang out and go search the websites and go check your email.
Right.
It doesn't work like that. It only gives you that minute when you actually talk to someone live. Otherwise, if you just got voicemail, you click the button, it's right to the next call. So
yeah.
it might
yeah,
be every
I love
30
it.
Seconds you're clicking that voicemail button, and it's just way faster than you could ever do mm-hmm. it manually, because manually you'd actually have to listen to their entire voicemail and leave your voicemail, which you cut mm-hmm. out both pieces with this tool.
Yeah. The other thing I like about it, or things like this, is that you get that focused intensity where you are ramped up and you're ready, and that's what you're doing at that time, as opposed to if people, let's say it was you're going to make 40 calls over the course of, you know, 4 hours. You could do that slowly, and it would, if it's the same amount of actual calls that you get out, you do it over 4 hours as opposed to doing it over 2 hours. In the 2 hours, you're really present, you're really ramped up, that's what you're doing, you have this focused intensity. In the 4 hour version of it, you might be not quite on your game, you're not really paying attention, you're not really engaged, you might be bored. And there's such a higher chance of you getting off track when you got that kind of slippage going on in your focus, you know?
Totally. It's like when you're talking to someone on the phone and you're replying to an email at the same time, you're not very engaged in the phone conversation, and you end up having to rewrite the email as well because you're doing a crappy job on both, because when you chase two rabbits, you catch neither one. So you think you're being efficient by multitasking. You're really just making yourself less effective and less efficient. So, it's all good stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because you talked about the difference between multitasking and I think you called it switching tasks, right? Can you talk a little bit
switch
about
tasking.
That, because that's also something.
Yeah.
Switch tasking, yeah.
So,
talk
so
about that a little
multitasking,
bit.
So there's a book I found in the – Jeff and Nick from KBIC have given me a lot of books over the years. So I was in the airport one day. I saw this book, The Myth of Multitasking, and I ended up buying it for both them. And it talks about multitasking as a term that was originally created to describe computers, which actually do multitask. They run multiple tasks at the same time. Humans, as much as we think we are not actually computers. We don't multitask. We switch tasks. And every time you switch back and forth, there is a time cost. For some people, that time cost is very small. For others, that time cost is large, where you got to refocus, find your place, get your head back into what you're doing, and continue on. And that's why when you're multitasking, you become, you know, you lose your place, you aren't really hearing what someone's saying on the other end of the phone, and you're also not picking up to the nonverbal communication where things that they're not saying, and you're not thinking, the point is, I don't know where I'm trying to go with this.
You were saying you're missing nonverbal cues.
Yeah. Exactly. Humans can't really multitask. We switch tasks, and it makes you less effective at both tasks, and it takes you longer. You think by multitasking it's saving you time. It's actually costing you time.
And that's why
having a dedicated planning time where you're doing all your planning activities at once, having your dedicated call block time where you're making all your calls at once, having your dedicated email time where you respond to all your emails at once is so much more effective.
Yeah. The interesting thing is this has changed over the last 10 years. Part of it is just the dopamine fix that people get from checking your phone, checking your Facebook feed, checking to see who's emailed you, who's texted. And they've done studies on it where people actually get a hit of pleasurable hormones in their brain when they do that. And the more that you check these things, the more that you want that little tiny hit of, I don't know if it's dopamine or what the hormone is, but it's a pleasure hormone.
So flash bang power. It's basically the law of cause and effect. Are you going to be proactive and be the cause of things in your life? Are you going to be in the driver's seat of your life? Or are you going to be in the effect of responding to others, responding to others' emails, responding to others' phone calls, responding to others' texts, or Facebook posts or whatever. Do you want to be in the driver's seat of your life, or do you want to be in the passenger seat reacting to how life is happening to you? I would say the majority of people out there are happiest and most fulfilled in their life when they are in the driver's seat, they're being proactive, and they're living life doing the things that they want to do instead of reacting to others. So I feel you, and it's like it's such an empty feeling sitting there staring at your in, you know, every time an email comes in, looking to see who it's from, or every time, I mean, it's just, it's so much different than having your plan that you are executing on, reacting to others, just puts you in the passenger seat, and it makes you less effective, and you'll be less fulfilled.
And some of it is creating the environment to trigger that too, you know, so if you, if you're using something like CallLogic or other things that would do the same thing, you're eliminating distractions on purpose. You could take things out of your visual field. You could work in a place that has the right amount of auditory stimulation. You could make sure that you don't get interrupted. There's a lot of things you can do to try to make sure that you, you really protect that focus. How do you either teach this or, I don't want to say enforce this, but I deal with a lot of firms that I consult with who are having issues, particularly virtual firms, where they don't know what the recruiters are up to. And they maybe are dealing with millennials who are just used to checking their phone literally 100 and whatever it is, 100 plus times a day, and getting distracted on social media and thinking that multitasking is obviously more effective. How do you teach everything we just talked about to your young or not so young team? And then also, how do you track, or do you track in any way, what somebody is doing across the country with this kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it's like building, we've all got habits and we've all got choices that we make, and our life is a result of our choices. And if you make really good choices, you're going to get really good results. And if you make really poor choices, you're going to get poor results. And choices that you make consistently in a predictable way become a habit. If you consistently wake up at 5 a.m. and drink water and meditate and work out, and then you eat healthy and do all these things, you have massive amounts of energy, and you have a smile on your face. And it's amazing that good things tend to happen in your business when that's your physiology versus, say, you stay out till 2 in the morning, drink heavily, do other things, poison your body, and then you wake up, like, literally need to drag yourself out of the bed. You need to drink 3 cups of coffee just to feel semi-normal, and then, you know, that's your attitude that you're just trying to make it through the day. How are you going to show up in your business in that physiology? And I'm kind of going to 2 extremes here, but you think about the choices you make every day and what are your habits, both in your health, in your business, in your relationships, in your spiritual life. I mean, a lot of those things kind of tie in together. So if you're, you need to allow yourself to get distracted. You need to choose, and it's either a conscious choice or a subconscious choice. You don't consciously choose to make your heart beat 60, 80, 100, 150 times a minute. Your subconscious mind does that. You think, I'm not consciously choosing to check my phone and check Facebook, but because you're just so programmed, you've got this habit so deeply ingrained from so much repetition that it almost feels just natural. Oh, I'm not even choosing to do this. I just find myself in between calls, navigating to ESPN.com and cyclingnews.com, and it's like it's almost natural. I don't even have to think about it. Sometimes, so I'm a big fan of, you know, the concept of living intentionally, and think of it like this. Everything in life that you want is uphill. And you don't go uphill by accident. If you ever tried climbing a mountain, you don't climb a mountain by accident. Now, think of the flip side. If you're on a bicycle and you're rolling downhill, you don't have to try very hard to ride a bicycle downhill. It's just, it happens for you. It takes zero effort. Everything in life that you want, especially everything in your business, everything you want as a recruiter, you want to make money, you want to be successful, you want to build your desk, build client relations, build your reputation, your industry, all of these things are uphill. You got to go climb the mountain. You got to put forth an intentional, purposeful effort to achieve what's uphill. The problem is most of us have downhill habits. checking our phone, checking our personal websites, checking social media about stuff that's not business related. And these are downhill habits, and either you're going to make a choice. It's kind of like making a choice to eat a healthy diet and exercise. Those two things, you have to be intentional. There aren't, like, as much as McDonald's might try, there aren't super healthy fast food restaurants. You know, they make it very easy and convenient to be unhealthy. It's not easy to be super healthy from an exercise standpoint. You need to invest hours and hours of your time, usually waking up early or doing it late before or after work. It's just easier to be unhealthy. And so, you know, I would say in terms of how do you train these people, it's what do you want and what are you willing to give up to go up? If you want to be super successful in this business, are you willing to give up checking Facebook 100 times a day in order to go bill $1 million a year or whatever your billing goal is? What are you willing to give up to go up? Same thing with your peer group. Hey, I want to be super successful, healthy, loving, giving, caring, but the people I surround myself with are just barely getting by, getting paid hourly. They probably poison their body and are not very healthy. They probably aren't loving, giving, living in abundance type of people. Hey, sometimes you got to give up people from your peer group if they're holding you back from becoming the type of person living the quality of life that you want to live. So I'm kind of going off on a...
I love it.
Here, but,
no, I'm taking notes. This is really good.
I don't think it's just a millennial thing because, you know, I'm like a cusper. I'm on the cusp of, I was born in 80, so I'm on the cusp of the millennials. I prefer to call myself millennial than a Gen Xer, but I know millennials that work their ass off and have great habits, and I know Gen Xers and baby boomers that are on the downhill habit side of the spectrum. So I don't want to make it as much about, I mean, I know my mother, like, my mom, for example, she's like addicted to Facebook and she was born in 51. So I don't think it's an age thing as much. She's also retired and on disability and all those things. So it's not like it's interrupting with her work day, but, the point is either you've got habits, either you choose to continue the habits and you keep getting what you've got, or you got to choose what are you willing to give up to go up in order to get what you want.
That's, well, if that's what you're telling your people, I can see why you guys are so successful, because that is a great message. I mean, that was really the part that really stuck out to me is everything that you want is uphill. And I think that's such a good message for people to get, that requires effort and focused concentration. Does that come from a teaching, a trainer, anything, or is that something that I've never heard that before?
So I've always been into Tony Robbins for about 15 years. Just in the past year or so, I've gotten more into John Maxwell and the concept of what are you willing to give up to go up. I adopted from John Maxwell, and he's got a book called Living Intentionally, which I bought. It's sitting on my night table. I hate to say I haven't gotten into it yet, but I've also been getting into his teaching programs and certification programs because I'm working on becoming a John Maxwell certified speaker and coach and trainer. Is that idea that, hey, everything we want in life is uphill, but we have downhill habits, and our downhill habits are not going to help us climb the mountain. If you want to, if you want to achieve something that's uphill, then you got to put in the blood and sweat and whatever it takes to climb the mountain. I'm a cyclist, so it makes sense to me. I could be on a big descent and like sit up with my hands off the handlebars, just feeling the wind in my hair, going downhill for 10 miles. As soon as the road goes uphill, you are not going to go uphill one mile on accident. Like you need to be very intentional to go uphill. So that analogy really made sense to me. It makes sense to me in my business as well.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense to me too. There's something that's kind of related, a little different, I think, is just the concept of voluntary hardship. You know, that you don't need to walk from your car to take the stairs to wherever you're going, but you volunteer to do that because that hardship is giving you something. And so if there's things in life that you look at somebody doing something and you think, ugh, that looks hard, it's just a shift in perspective where you say, that looks hard, so I'm going to try it. You know, that looks hard, so I think I want to check it out. and I just started riding my bike to work, and it's not far at all. I don't know how many miles it is, but it's close. It's about a 15-20 minute bike ride. And, you know, it's easier to get up, get in my car, and drive to my office. But it's so much more fulfilling and fun and changes my mood, my outlook, how I'm looking at the day or how I'm decompressing from the end of the day to just get on my bike and ride home from my office. I mean, it's that one small little change. You could call it a voluntary hardship. It has made a tremendous difference just in the last couple of months, you know, so it's,
I'm curious, Gary, what was your reason for starting to commute on your bike to work?
You know, I think I did it as I hadn't rode my bike in a while, and I've got a motorcycle that I ride like a Banshee. So I'm always riding my motorcycle. I do a lot of strength training. I do a lot of, working out, but I just have not really been on a bike in a long time. And I thought I want to get my bike and actually do something with it. And I've always liked the idea of using a bike as a functional tool as opposed to just, you know, I was in Mexico recently and everybody there is riding bikes to go get the groceries or they're riding bikes to go do stuff around town. And I love that idea that the bike can be a way to slow down and see things and kind of smell the air and be outside in the sunshine. Really, it was just kind of a little experiment, like, hey, I'll just try riding my bike to work. And I, from the first day, was just completely hooked. So I'm just trying to find excuses now to ride all over town to do my errands, and it's fantastic. You know?
Yeah, I agree. The bicycle is addicting in a good way.
Yeah.
I love the bike. It's my favorite. It's my passion. It's my favorite thing. So typically when someone starts making some different decisions around their health, it's because they have some kind of goal, like, I want to lose this much weight, or, for example, hey, I signed up for this half marathon. Oh, well, now I got to run this amount because, well, I signed up for this half marathon. I got to do it. You've got a purpose. You've got something driving you. So when someone says, hey, you want to go out to the bar after work, you say, I'm sorry, I can't. I've got to train. Or, no, I can't eat that. Or, no, I'm not going to have a drink because of this. For example, Jessica and I, before we had little Ryder, we went to this Healthy Bodies, Healthy Baby class, and they're like, yeah, you as a dad, for the 3 months before your baby is created, you're supposed to essentially act like you are pregnant and live this wholesome, poison-free life. And I'm like, wow, I'm not sure I could ever do that. I guess we're not having kids. Like, but hey, once I got on board with Jessica on the whole healthy body, healthy baby train, it's like, no, I can't have a drink. I got to make a healthy baby. No, I can't eat that. I can't put poison in my body because I got to make a healthy baby. It was a very big why. So, on that note, when you talk about voluntary hardships, I think it's a lot easier to say no to things you would have otherwise said yes to. When you've got a big why that you're striving to achieve. And it shouldn't just be about the money, whether it's what are your billings or what are your commissions. It's what are you going to do with that money? Well, I want to buy this house, or I want to put this kid, you know, pay for my kid's college fund, or I want to take this trip to this country. And, you know, maybe that would help people. Well, you know, and I'll give an example. I had a problem with reading negative news. And I'm not talking about CNBC or CNN or mainstream media news. I'm talking about alternative media news, which tends to all be bad. And the truth is, a lot of this negative news probably is true. It's really happening. But what I found was I was reading so much negative news, it was making me a more negative person. And I didn't want to grow. I didn't want to invest in the future because what's the point? It's all going to collapse anyways. We're this close. We're in a tinderbox, and, you know, one spark and it's all going down. And I, it wasn't serving me. It certainly wasn't serving Jessica. And so I went on a 30-day news cleanse where I literally, I deleted all of the bookmarks on my phone and on my computer, and I would not allow myself to open any kind of news website. Well, I think my exception was ESPN and Cycling News. So I'm like, oh, nothing negative can happen on these great sports websites that I read. That was my cheat. But anyways, after 30 days, I was a much more positive and happy-go-lucky person again because I wasn't letting all the negative crap going on in the world that's totally outside of my control anyways affect me.
Yeah.
So sometimes you, I'm not a big moderation person. I'm kind of all or nothing. So if you need to literally say, shoot, I got to delete my Facebook account, if that's what it takes to get you to stop checking your Facebook 100 times a day, maybe do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you need, I'm the kind of person, when I need to get healthy, I need to stop drinking entirely. Because I can't, I'm the kind of person who likes to have one or two beers a day every day, and then on the weekends I'm going to have more. I don't cut down or moderate. I kind of go all or nothing. So for going back to your question about how do we train millennials or any people to do this or not do something, sometimes you got to just go cold turkey, draw a line in the sand.
Yeah.
But you need a big why to mentally commit to why you're doing that. Why am I forcing myself into this? Why am I volunteering for this hardship? Well, there needs to be a big enough payoff. Why am I doing that? So I would say if you could wrap your person's head around the why, then the how will become that much easier.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because I just, if you've read Tony Robbins, he talks about the book, The Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a psych student in college, and he was a theorist that we spent, I don't know, maybe, you know, a week or less on logotherapy, his therapy. But I think that's in the first chapter. And those of you listening, if you don't know, he was a concentration camp. He was a psychiatrist who was put into a concentration camp and then later wrote about it and came up with a form of therapy based on meaning, basically, what meaning people apply to things. And I think it's in the first few pages he says exactly that. You know, you can survive anything if you have a big enough why. So I think that would be the autocorrect for bad habits if people could really get really connected to a deep why like that. Let me do a quick recap of what we've covered so far, give you a chance to catch your breath, Jordan, and then we will pick up and keep going and switch gears a little bit, maybe talk about being a top producer and technology, because I know that's something that you're really good with your firm as far as knowing what tech to use to be mobile. So for those of you listening, I just want to give you a chance to catch your breath and see where we've come so far. We talked first of all about the virtual team and how that's comprised with Jordan's setup. He's got different people who handle basically a deconstructed assembly line where people know what their jobs are and they're supporting each other. We talked about CallLogic, which is the technology that Jordan's company uses to actually dial and make calls and speed up that process. Around that, we talked about planning that has to happen separately in order to make CallLogic work and be able to execute those calls. Talked about the fact that this is still a phone business and that that's a metric that is important to make sure that you protect and connect with your clients on the phone. Talked about the getting job order leads, having your assistant be able to get job order leads. And Jordan went through the process that Christina goes through in his office where she actually watches career pages, LinkedIn, and news for finding out who's got rounds of funding and then helps to deliver that information to the account executives who then make the marketing calls. And we talked about the difference between multitasking and what's actually switch tasking, meaning that there is no multitasking, there's only switching tasks, and that lowers productivity, and that single tasking is really where you want to be. And then the last thing we talked a little bit is really about finding a why, right? The question was around a little bit different topic, but the why question is really crucial, and Jordan spent a lot of time going through how that translates, that having a strong enough why motivates you to do what it takes. And he said, quote, everything that you want is uphill. You have to do it intentionally. And with that, we're going to end this segment, but there is going to be a part two of this this very interesting time with Jordan. So, Jordan, thanks so much for joining me for this first part. We will be back next month with part two of this interview. For those of you listening, thanks for being a member. And I will be back next month with part two of the interview with Jordan Rayboy. Bye-bye.